WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Randall Robinson, one of the key figures in the American campaign against apartheid in South Africa. In 1984 and 85, he led a series of daily sit-ins outside the South African embassy in Washington, D.C., protesting apartheid. Approximately 3,600 people were arrested during that year of demonstrations, including tennis star Arthur Ashe, first daughter Amy Carter, 23 members of Congress, including Senator Lowell Weicker, and several mayors. Robinson is the national coordinator of the Free South Africa movement. He's also the founding executive director of Trans Africa, a lobbying group which focuses on African and Caribbean issues. Robinson grew up in Richmond, Virginia, while it was still segregated. The first integrated school he attended was Harvard Law School. Earlier today in Philadelphia, he addressed a conference on the black perspective on the Constitution's bicentennial at Drexel University. Randall Robinson, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with your first trip to South Africa. Now, this was in December 76. You went, I believe, with a congressional delegation. I'm sure you had braced yourself to be in the country of apartheid, but what were you unprepared for when you landed there?
Well, that one can intellectually prepare, but you can't emotionally prepare. And I was surprised to learn how much emotionally I had healed from my own experience in the American South, and how so much of that pain was renewed during my stay in South Africa. It was a searing, very biting, hurtful experience. It tore scar tissue off old wounds. I remember one exchange so vividly. We were in the American consulate at Cape Town. The delegation was led by Charles Diggs. We had, I think, one senator in the delegation, Joe Biden. John Anderson, there were seven members of the Congressional Black Caucus in the group. And we were talking to a group of white South African businessmen. And we had talked in a very circular fashion for a long time about nothing of any real consequence. And Congressman Diggs said, I think we ought to get to the core of the issue, the real problem. Here that has to be resolved is the problem of a franchise, and when the white minority will be prepared to give the black majority the right to vote. The whites seemed startled by the question and went through some silent process of electing the one who would answer the question, as if Congressman Diggs had uttered some heresy. And then he gave an answer, all the more shocking because it was given without malice. He said to put a vote in the hands of blacks would be like giving guns to 5-year-olds. And then we were shocked. And I thought my childhood had insulated me from shock.
I guess it was not only the statement, but his ease in saying
the
it
ease
that
in
was
saying
so shocking.
He seemed to be, they seemed to be dumbfounded by such a question, so cut off from the rest of the world, so cut off from civilized and organized humanity in their own bestial social practices that they simply seemed never to have contemplated any transfer of power of that kind. We went into the next room to show you how the ships pass in the South African night. Went into the next room and listened to a young South African minister in a discussion that began a friendship that has lasted for 11 years. Who spelled out in graphic terms with great courage, because he had to have known that the South Africans would have access to what he was telling us, spelled out in some great detail the nuts and bolts of apartheid and would be required to change that that awful system. His name was Alan Bosack, and he's come to be one of the great great leaders in the struggle there. As a matter of fact, I shared a Sunday platform at Bright Hope Baptist Church here on Sunday as Reverend Bosack spoke at Congressman William Gray's church here in Philadelphia. But we left there later that day to go to the airport. Perhaps this the story here is even more remarkable, even more tragic. We went to the airport. Our plane, one of these United States of America planes, was commanded by Colonel John Farr, a black a colonel. And, of course, it was staffed by U.S. Air Force personnel. Airmen were the cooks, and we had a black State Department doctor on board. I think this kind of command and this kind of delegation was a little known about in South Africa. It sort of shocked their senses. And I recall going to the gate with the delegation behind Colonel Farr to see if the plane had been serviced and was ready to depart to Freetown, Sierra Leone. And Colonel Farr asked the white airport supervisor if the plane was ready. And he got no answer, nothing. He said, I'm Colonel Farr. I'm in command of this United States aircraft. Is the plane prepared? Has it been serviced and fueled? And is it ready to depart? No answer. For the airport official could not arrange his thoughts to contemplate, to accept that this black American was in command of a United States of America aircraft. And so he looked past Colonel Farr and addressed his comment to a steward, a cook, an airman, a 19-year-old child of the lowest rank in the Air Force behind Colonel Farr. And he said, sir, the plane is ready. Of course, the child was embarrassed. it was an unbelievable situation. And Congressman Charles Rangel said, I don't think you know what you're doing. And to avoid an international incident, you'd better clear away and make this plane ready so we can depart.
So a lot of people have been appalled at circumstances that they've witnessed in other countries. And then they come back home, and slowly the anger wears off, and the problem seems far away, and you readjust to your life at home. This did not happen with you. The anger and the shock stayed with you. Why?
Well, I used to believe when I was a child that as a child with tunnel vision, as we all have, prisoner of one's hometown, that racism was a phenomenon of the American South. Then I went to Boston to law school. I discovered it was a bigger problem than I thought. And then I went to live in Africa. And you find how far American private and public sector tentacles reach. I think it's particularly important in the year of the 200-year constitutional celebration that we talk about what the values of the Constitution are to mean to us and how we would expect our foreign policy to be imbued with some of the liberty and freedom and democracy that we cherish. And oftentimes we find our foreign policy doesn't seem to be influenced at all by it. So when you're in South Africa, you understand clearly what your responsibility as an American is once you come home, because the cars are ours. And when one looks up on the billboards, you see our companies named. When you look at the oil companies, they're our oil companies. South Africa has no oil. We give it to them. We refine it. Have no computers. We've computerized the whole thing. So that the Western community, led by the United States, supplies the legs on which this monster stands. So a part of our responsibility, both to them and to ourselves, is to come back and do what we can. Now, that's my responsibility as a human being. That's my responsibility as an American.
As we all know, black Americans haven't achieved real equality in America. So I think for any politically motivated Black American, there's probably this question of priority, which is going to come first in your political organizing, working at home, or working on issues abroad?
That's a question that's asked all the time. They have to all enjoy equal footing. We're not full-fledged Americans, Americans without asterisks, until we participate in every aspect of this country's business. And that means that we not only have to strive to do that, but Americans have to learn to perceive us in every sector of American activity. We've never had an American Secretary of State. We've never had an Assistant Secretary for Africa. Our numbers are too low in the ambassadorial corps. For too long, there have been barriers not only to Black Americans, but to ethnic hyphenates in this country, and the participation in the foreign policy process. When Martin Luther King spoke out against the Vietnam War, a part of the response to his statement was that he was a civil rights leader. What's he to do with this? And he was thoughtful about it. He was accurate about it. He's been vindicated by history. And yet other religious leaders like Jerry Falwell, who hasn't the faintest notion of what South Africa and other foreign policy issues are about, never been met with such negative reaction. It's because King was Black, and there still is that kind of a discouragement to Black participation in other sectors, thinking that if it's Black, it has to do with civil rights. No, we are not represented adequately in many of the power corridors, in industry, in business, in academia, in media. It's not who's in front of the camera that counts in this business. It's who makes the editorial decisions. It's who's in that editorial room at the New York Times and the Washington Post and AP and UPI and ABC, CBS and NBC. That's where it counts. And we still find ourselves underrepresented in those capacities. So we've got a long way to go. And these things complement each other. Until we're free in South Africa, and I don't mean this in any kind of romantic way, I'm talking about in full control of resources on which the world depends, commodity raw materials and precious minerals and the like, and then we won't come to any full power, because power in the last analysis is rooted in economic capacity.
I want to talk more about your work regarding South Africa, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Randall Robinson. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Robinson. He's the national coordinator of the Free South African Movement. He's also the founding executive director of Trans Africa, which is a lobbying group that focuses on African and Caribbean issues. Well, we're talking about your trip to South Africa and how you came back and decided to organize around an anti-apartheid campaign.
Sure.
Now, when you came back to America, this is in 1977, there wasn't the same American awareness of apartheid that there is now. When you started talking to Americans about what you witnessed in South Africa, did people really understand what you were talking about?
No, not then. Charles Diggs, at the time, headed the Subcommittee on Africa in the House of Representatives, and we couldn't get a sanctions bill out of his own subcommittee, much less the full committee. Now it has passed, of course, the House and the Senate, and we've overridden the veto of the President of the United States. Of course, Congress doesn't lead. It largely follows public sentiment, and that had to be developed. And it meant that you had to put this issue squarely in the middle of the American public policy agenda, and you had to do it through television. I think the embassy demonstrations with celebrities offering themselves for arrest made this a great American story. And when it became that story, because I've always maintained that if you can put the facts before the American people, that they will decide fairly what our policy ought to be. And that's been demonstrated so far.
Well, you were one of the first people to get arrested. You sat in front of the South African embassy with Mary Frances Berry and with Walter Fauntleroy, and you were all arrested. This was the first demonstration that you held there,
yes,
that led to the year of sit-ins outside the embassy. Did you think you were going to get arrested?
Well, we virtually knew that. We went into the embassy to have a meeting with Ambassador Faure, and we demanded that the political prisoners in South Africa be released, Nelson Mandela and all of the thousands of others, and that a constitutional convention be convened and progress begin towards a democratization in that country, and that we weren't going to leave the embassy until the South African government had made a firm commitment. He left the room for about a half hour, presumably to consult with Pretoria and likely the State Department, and came back in and told us to leave or we'd be subject to arrest, and we didn't, and we were arrested. Now, we had no idea what was going to follow, that for the first time perhaps in this country's history, demonstrations with civil disobedience and arrest ran nonstop for a year, the longest nonstop demonstration that that I can recall.
Was it ever hard to get fresh bodies who were willing to sit in and
never
be arrested?
Never hard to get bodies. It was hard to, one had to apportion the bodies in the sense that you had to schedule some of this. We would have on some days 100 arrestees and on other days two. But people came from all over the country. It was a reaffirmation of the promise that this country offers. I would assume roughly that 30% were black and 70% white from all walks, from all classes, from all regions of this country, who were making not only a statement about apartheid, but a statement about ourselves, a statement about what we claim to be, what our Constitution suggests that we should be. It was the Americans saying the best about themselves.
How was everybody treated when they were arrested?
I think very properly, in as much as treated as all people should be treated when they are arrested. We were given no special privileges. We were processed and fingerprinted and photographed and locked up and handcuffed and kept overnight and released on our own recognizance the next day. But I think the police carried out their duties as they were supposed to. We really wanted trials. And the failure was in the administration, the Justice Department, elected not to go forward with any trials. I was arrested a total of seven times, and I was not tried once, and I think that was because the administration did not want its policies put on trial before the American public. But the public got the point in any case, and sanctions were passed over the president's veto. Not the kinds of sanctions we need. I mean, we need much stronger sanctions, and we're going to push again to get those. But the real disgrace is that we have in the White House a president that the South African government feels that it can count on. And that's a sad statement for our nation.
The protests in front of the embassy lasted a year. When did you decide to call it off?
We never called it off. We stopped holding it daily. We still have periodic demonstrations at the embassy. But it began to be more difficult to do after the sanctions were passed. It's victory is almost as difficult to manage as defeat, particularly when you don't have full victory, which we didn't. But sanctions gave the impression that we'd come further than we had. We need much tougher sanctions now.
One of the things we've seen happen in the past year is that a lot of American businesses have pulled out of South Africa. And this is something that the disinvestment campaign has been pushing for a long time. Do you think that the pulling out of American businesses is having the effect that people who oppose apartheid hoped that it would?
Well, I think it's important to say first that the sanctions that we have, were they as tough as those imposed on Rhodesia? Were they global? Were they comprehensive to require all businesses to pull out, an end to trade, an end to everything? You would not be able to measure with any accuracy the effects of that on the government in the space of 1 year. Rhodesia, a much smaller economy, withstood global sanctions for nearly a decade before they had no choice but to go to the table to negotiate towards what has become a democratic Rhodesia. The answer to your question, as best we can measure, is that the sanctions have troubled the economy of South Africa. It's in a sad state, and had not the price of gold revived some, it would be in a sadder state. They cannot go on indefinitely, but to make this thing really work, we have to shut all the doors. It means that we have to have sanctions in the UN Security Council. The Congress cannot require constitutionally the president to seek such sanctions. And so we've got to make this an issue in the 88 presidential election campaign. The corporations have begun to come out, but a great deal of that has been sleight of hand. Many of them have followed the so-called Japanese model. They've sold their assets to white buyers in South Africa and continue to market their products to those white purchasers of those assets. So IBM equipment is still there. GM is still there. It's as if they're there, but they're not. They've dealt with their public relations problem, but they've not dealt with their culpability for the crime of apartheid. So we need better legislation, and we need a prohibition on trade. Once we get that, then those corporations won't be able to be there. Also, the real underpinning has not pulled out at all. The computer companies can still be there and supply computers to non-apartheid enforcing agencies. Computers are as fungible as money. If you send them in, they'll find their way to the wrong place. We have no capacity to monitor that. But more importantly, South Africa has no oil. It's a munition of war under South Africa law and cloaked in secrecy. The oil they get comes through American companies, Caltex, Mobil, Exxon. Mobil has the largest refinery, together with Shell, in South Africa. If those companies were to pull out, if we could stop the oil flow, South Africa would grind to a halt.
Seems to me you're working a dual campaign. On the one hand, public campaigns through the kinds of protests that you staged for a year, events that would help you get coverage on the media, but also behind-the-scenes work in Congress that gets less media attention, but is important
to carry out
your goals of getting sanctions.
I think you put your finger right on it. You can't operate on one track unless you're operating effectively on the other. Everybody in Washington knows that unless an issue gets publicity, you're not going to get out of any committee. You're not going to get to the floor, and you're not going to get the majority you want. So you have to create public support for what you're trying to do legislatively. But public support is not an end in itself. We've got to change American policy.
I want to talk about your life a little bit. You went to Harvard Law School. This was actually the first school that you went to that was integrated. You grew up in segregated Richmond, Virginia. Harvard Law School is great training for corporate lawyers. Did you ever go that route or consider going that route instead of getting into political activism?
No. I learned at Harvard a lot. Perhaps most importantly, I learned I didn't want to practice law. I liked law school a lot better than I liked the practice of it. I did it for a year, poverty law in Boston at the Boston Legal Assistance Project. But I absolutely loathed it. It's you can't believe the killing boredom of it, and to play out one's career in the sole society of lawyers is a fate worse than death.
Strong words.
I never thought about it beyond the first year. Although I found the law school experience a very stimulating one, and a very helpful one in my career. But there are an awful lot of people train in law who never intend to practice it.
Now, I have to ask you one question about your brother, who's Max Robinson, who's a news anchor. Has he ever had trouble covering certain stories or reporting on certain stories because you were part of the story?
Well, it was once charged that I had favorable treatment from ABC because he was at ABC. And if anything, it worked in the other direction. At the time that he was there, I got better coverage from the other networks. But after he left, I've gotten more coverage from ABC. I think he and I leaned over backward to make certain that there was no foundation for such a perception. We've only appeared once together on a trip home to where we grew up for a talk on Essence Television. It was the only thing we've ever done on television together.
Is it hard for you to be as close as you'd like to because of the professions that you're in?
No, he has always risked great trouble in his profession with candor. And I'm very proud of him for that. He's never let his work make a prisoner of his convictions. And so it hasn't been all that difficult. I've got enough sense, though, to never ask him to do things I think he shouldn't do, but he would want to do.
I really regret that we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much
for
speaking with us
me.
Today. My guest has been Randall Robinson. He's the founder and director of the lobbying group Trans Africa, which focuses on African and Caribbean countries, and is one of the principal architects of the anti-apartheid Free South Africa movement in the United States. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.